I'd like to welcome David Dean to the NAC today. And David, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your experience in the ARC last year. And what do you love about the play, some of the plays we're doing this year?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, I think when I suggested I might be part of the ARC, I did have an ulterior motive, and part of that motive was to really close the gap between myself and the period that I've been working on and off for several years now. And in particular, I think historians have a difficulty. We have a very traditional way of doing our job, which is to uncover the past, and traditionally we look at a variety of sources, usually documentary, political sort of sources, documents, and printed as well as manuscript sources. Sometimes we look at coins and material culture, and sometimes we even get a little bit weird about things, and we try and find spaces from the past, a bit like Washington Irving trying to find the boar's head, you know. We try and encounter the past and bridge that gap, that historical distance. And for me, plays are one of the ways in which different voices appear in my sources, where there's alternative views expressed, or there's words that are used and phrases are used and sentences are used and actions happen which have variable meanings. And it's the variable meanings that I found very exciting in being part of the ARC. Particularly, I think texts that I knew, plays that I knew that I'd read as texts, almost read as cold texts on a play, on a page. It's a cliche to say they came alive, but they did come alive. But they also varied enormously depending on who was actually doing the particular part. And if I take something like The Witch of Edmonton, for example, which a play I knew well from the pamphlet that had come before that, I hadn't quite understood the passion and the humanness of the witch in the way that it was performed by Claire, I think it was.
Claire Coulter, yeah.
It was an extraordinary experience. And then one little episode that struck me is I'd been working with my students just a few months before on some of the pamphlets, and we'd been looking at the familiars, which are the little animals that the witch has as her assistants. And there's some wonderful little woodcuts of these familiars, yeah, feeding off their breasts and things and being supported by them. And one of the young students decided, on hearing that a cat was very often, or a ferret was very often, one of these characters, read his part with a meow sound to it. And for the first time, I think there were only three or four lines he had in the entire,
yes,
play, but they were spine-chilling.
Yeah.
And so for me, that being part of the ARC, I came away from the ARC, you know, really it was a transformative experience, because these texts, which I'd seen as, you know, I'd been using all my historical skills and analyzing them and reading them and understanding them and putting them in larger contexts, all of which is very important, I'd forgotten that they were something very passionate, there's something essentially human about them, and that they spoke to me as a person in a way that was somewhat different from myself as a historian. And it's hard to describe, but it you know, at times I had tears in my eyes in that room,
yeah,
listening to some people read some of the parts. Woman Killed with Kindness, you know, I'd studied as a student and I taught it, and I'd always taught it as a sort of text that it deals with providentialism or various themes like that, companionate marriage versus love and so on. And I hadn't anticipated feeling so angry, uh-huh, at the husband, and feeling that this was a complete setup. And you know, not saying that is a correct reading or an incorrect reading, but it's a different reading. And it brought something new to these texts that I just hadn't expected to encounter. So it's...
Maybe I should tell our listeners that what we did in the ARC is we spent 3 weeks, and each morning was dedicated to a specific area of research. So we would look at language, we'd look at rhetoric. David provided for us a sort of general overview into the Elizabethan period, the Jacobean period, and the Restoration period. He took the actors to the art gallery one day and went through the Renaissance collection of paintings to see the imagery in visual art that was also reflected in the dramatic art. So those were the mornings. And then the afternoon, we read a different play each afternoon and started with the plays of Christopher Marlowe, who was a dramatist, a peer of Shakespeare's, in fact, born the very same year, and was killed in 1593-94. And we started with him. We worked through the plays of Shakespeare, his contemporaries, and the playwrights that followed him. So some of the texts David's mentioned, The Witch of Edmonton is a play by Thomas Dekker, John Ford, and William Rowley, who were all contemporaries of Shakespeare, worked with Shakespeare. It's believed perhaps some of them collaborated with Shakespeare. And so all of a sudden, it's a portrait of a time, of an age, by seeing such a variety of writers. And a funny thing that I love is that when you're doing historical research for a theatrical play, you go through the books, the sources they cite are these plays. And so there's a kind of cyclical connection between history and theater. What's your, why are these plays worth revisiting?
Well,
Why study history?
Well, I mean, the conventional answer to that question is that history, you know, you have to know yourself, you have to know your past, right, to know where we are as individuals or as families or as communities or as nations. We need to revisit the past, and we have to accept responsibility for the past. I mean, in England right now, there's a huge debate over apologies for the slave trade, and it's generated an enormous debate in England. And I was listening to, reading the blogs and listening to talk shows and things over the net, and it's fascinating the number of people who argue that yes, the slave trade was wrong, yes, it was diabolical, yes, we should I recognize that we committed something that was close to an atrocity, but I shouldn't apologize for it. I have no personal responsibility for it. I'm living now. What my great-great-grandparents did is nothing to do with me. And we have it's an ongoing debate in many societies. It's issues in Turkey over the Armenian genocide, issues to do with Nazi war guilt, issues of the Poles and how they deal with their past. It seems to be something that we're at the moment trying to grapple with. Not only do we acknowledge what happened in the past, the good things and the bad things, but we also take responsibility for them, and we recognize that where we are today is partly because of those things that happened in the past. So my answer to those people who say, you know, it's not my responsibility, I'm born now, I didn't benefit from it directly. Well, of course we benefited from it directly. I'm English by descent and by inclination, and my culture, you know, my family comes from Lancashire, which benefited enormously from the slave trade and wouldn't be as wealthy as it is today without that slave trade. So there's, for me, the past speaks very much to the present. It tells us very much where we are and how we got here. But that's the conventional answer. I think the more important answer for me personally is that the past speaks to me. One of my students said he quite enjoyed one of my lectures a little while ago, and it was because I'd slipped from the past to the present tense. And what I was doing was describing how a minister in the 1560s, a minister of the church, would have felt having to put on the vestments that Elizabeth I had ordered him to put on. And if he was a Calvinist, a Puritan, who thought those vestments were signs of Catholicism, that for them he would want to rend them and tear them and rip them off. And I guess I got a little bit overly passionate about this in demonstrating it or describing it. But it was, I thought about what he said afterwards, and I realized I do feel very strongly that not only does the past lead to where we are today and help shape us where we are to understand ourselves, we do need to understand where we came from. But as well, we need to learn from that, and we need not to judge it, and we need to recognize that at certain points of time, it's time and space, other countries, other time periods, they are often wrestling with issues that we ourselves are still facing today or are wrestling with anew today. If I think of the plague that hit London in the 1660s, the way foreigners were targeted for that, foreigners were blamed for that. We're not we haven't got out of there yet. You know, with the SARS thing in Toronto, we sort of started to blame foreigners bringing it in. How did they deal with that? How do we deal with that? What can we learn from their experience? We're often very, we're very full of ourselves. You know, we think we're it. You know, there's a sort of the Enlightenment position where, you know, they are where it's at, and the Middle Ages were awful, and they were the, in quote, Dark Ages. And I often find myself reading plays or letters or personal accounts from the period I'm working on in the 16th, 17th century and finding, or other periods I teach on, and find myself really feeling like I'm there in the room with this person, or I'm really understanding what they're saying, because other times they do things that I find absolutely horrific, and I have no understanding. And you know, in some ways, that's where it gets most difficult for the historian, where you don't understand something, where it isn't transparent, where it's not obvious that you and they share anything. There's a famous story about a cat massacre where the apprentices in Paris go out and they massacre all the cats, and we find that horrific. We don't laugh. They found it horribly funny, and so the point of contact there for the historian is, why do they find it funny, as well as why do I not find it funny? And so my ancestors at some point found torturing cats amusing. Uh-huh. And symbolic of something and powerful. They found it very empowering to do it. And we don't feel that anymore. And I think that help understanding where they were coming from helps us understand where we've got to now. But I think it also helps us recognize that they were doing things in a way that we need to respect and value, and they might have something to teach us.
It's so interesting, because that's the challenge, I think, for all of the productions of the upcoming season, because some of them will be done in traditional costume and set in the period they were written, but others are going to be transported into the present. One play is making a cultural leap from an English depiction of Roman culture, now reinterpreted through First Nations artists. That process of interpretation and how meanings changed over the years, and what things meant originally to what they mean now, and how they stay the same. I find that, as a director, mm-hmm. very, very interesting. And as an audience, I find that really interesting too.
Yeah.
When you look at a play like Henry V, for example, it's a play that's really, no doubt about it, pro-war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a patriotic play about going to battle and fighting a fight. So it isn't the kind of anti-war kind of sentiment that we're more accustomed to seeing in the theater. And it's great, those challenges these plays present.
I know. So I was just reading, well, a couple of years ago, some work done on Sir John Falstaff, who you mentioned earlier, and just how, I can't remember the literary scholar's name, Dover Wilson perhaps, had written some analysis of Falstaff in the middle of the Second World War, and how he was trying to argue against the sort of celebration of the carnival, the sort of fantastical, uh-huh. grotesque, you know, and trying to deny that Falstaff would be at all attractive to the English for this, that the English are, you know, what we're really about is, you know, we're all, you know, very good men who will go into battle and support the king. And of course, Henry will do that. The prince will turn against Falstaff, and that will happen. But he's obviously reacting to a whole history, I guess, of literary criticism. I don't really know that, but I'm speculating. But also a huge appeal that Falstaff has for another aspect of English culture, which is, you know, maybe carries on with the Carry On films and the sort of, there's a Benny Hill and that sort of humor, you know, sort of quite grotesque, horrible humor that no one really wants to admit that they enjoy. And I think that was part of the war. It was part of the situation of the war that he's reinterpreting Shakespeare in light of that experience. And of course, Olivier does that with Henry V and the movie and so on. You can't show the king slaughtering prisoners at certain points of time. At other points of time, you can show that. Shakespeare had the same issue with Richard II, right? You could or you could not show the deposition of a king at certain times. But I was fascinated by what you just said about the way things change, because there's the historian in me would like to see an authentic performance. You know, my inclination is, you know, I was part of that 1980s tradition of, you know, wanting to go back to real ale or wanting to go back to authentic early music, you know, and performed on original instruments in the way it would have been. And of course, there's a silliness to that, because we're not entering those spaces covered in fleas, and you know, we're many of people watching it are in their 60s who would not be there if you ever were able to reenact the whole experience in an authentic way. So our desire for authenticity has severe limits.
It's like how, you know, I love seeing period films made in the 1940s.
Right.
Like Betty Davis as Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
And she might as well have a cocktail and a cigarette. She's swooning about. That somehow, or you can spot like an Elizabethan story, you can tell, oh, that film was made in the 60s.
Right.
The sensibility of the period somehow comes, that it was made, comes across more so in a historical film in some ways.
Right.
All those depictions from the 30s, those Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo movies, too, they look really 1930s. Yeah.
And then you have this exciting Kate Blanchett who's doing not quite a feminist interpretation, but it's certainly a complete focus on, you know, how this young woman is going to cope with this horrifically narrow-minded male world. And something which wasn't in some of the earlier performance. You know, Flora Robson wouldn't have been interested in that sort of concern.
Yeah. I mean, a great thing, though, like what you're saying about if we were to go back and try to see these plays as Shakespeare might have seen them or presented them, they would be outdoors. The Globe Theater had no roof, the wooden O. They would have been performed all by men. And the companies were all made up of men, and boy actors took on the female parts.
Right.
And it wasn't until later in the century when Charles II came from France and was restored to the throne, that's the Restoration, that actresses were brought onto the stage. I mean, there's something that we take for granted so simply.
Yeah.
And it means you have to listen in a different way. You think in a different way, and certainly we interpret the plays in a different way.
In a different way, yeah. Yeah, I think that must have been, Pepys in his diary, and Pepys is the great London diarist from the
16th. Samuel Pepys, yes.
And for listeners who don't know, he writes in the 1660s and compiles a diary in shorthand, which took 4 or 5 years in the early 19th century to decipher. And it's an extraordinary source for Restoration London life, because he goes to the plays and he, you know, does all sorts of things, buys his cheeses and buys his wine and records all of this and the coffee houses and so on. I mean, it's an extraordinary, it's a very rich source. But he talks about how Kynaston, I think, was the male actor who he said is one of the most beautiful women on stage. And there's one play he goes to where Kynaston moves three different roles, crossing genders, and then records the first female actresses that he sees. And it blows him away. There's this, the parts change, you know.
Yeah.
To have Desdemona, I can't imagine what it was like to have seen an Othello played, you know, with Desdemona as a young boy, being played by a young boy, and then going in there in what, 1660, December 1660, yeah. and seeing, was it Margaret Hughes?
Yeah, Margaret Hughes.
Playing Desdemona. And that must have just been a revolution.
And we see that plays change because romantic intimacy could only be depicted so far with boys. So it stays a bit formal. It stays not as deeply explored. And then you get to the Restoration. I think it's why sexual comedy just takes off because women and men are playing women and men on the stage for the first time.
I think that was something the Ark really taught me.
Yeah.
Was just watching the actors and actresses perform those parts. It's one thing to read it and just think of a young boy versus an older man, and that they're, you know, man and woman, and they're it is you're absolutely right. It works on the level of language. Whereas suddenly to see it performed by, you know, I remember it was at Todd who played this lecherous old man. I can't remember what the play was now.
It was an Afrobane play.
The Lucky Chance, yeah. And it was, I mean, he was horrific. I mean, we all were cringing and not wanting to be near him.
This is an old lecher who takes a young bride of 18 and is constantly fantasizing about their wedding night, much to the audience's laughter and disgust.
And I was wondering in that performance, was it Menon? I can't remember the who played that the young woman so well. But what would have that been like to be seen an old lecherous man and a young man?
Yes.
The dynamic would have been very different. And I guess also touch and the way you move on stage and what you can do with your body must have changed enormously in the Restoration because of that. Men are touching women now on stage. Women are touching men. Gestures have meanings that actually resonate with real life for many people or many more people. Not to say that everyone is heterosexual who's watching the plays in the Elizabethan period. So sometimes those touches may have had meaning for some people in the audience. As Alan Bray's written on homosexuality in the Elizabethan period, which there's another layer there of the stage too in Elizabeth's day. But that Restoration experience must have just been really much more than just a restoration. And when we talk about the Restoration, we should probably say what we literally mean is King Charles II coming back, Prince Charles, the son of Charles I, who'd been executed in 1649, coming back to the throne in 1660. And the question is, what will be restored? Will the church come back like it was? Will Parliament come back like it had been before the English Revolution, which was the 11-year period without a king? What will come back? What will be restored? But also there's an issue in terms of almost a new renaissance as well. There's you know, they celebrate Augustus and Charles comes in as triumph, and they're celebrating the Roman triumphs and so on. And it's this new imperial world that's coming back. The playhouses, as you know, get reopened, and women actresses on stage. It must have seemed a little bit more revolutionary or exciting than just a mere restoration tends to convey.
You know, yeah, when we think of the Restoration now, we tend to think of, you know, powdered wigs and beauty patches and fans and all of that, which is great fun. But there's also a real energy to that and meaning to all of that. Well, I think we oughtn't be coy anymore. We're trying to keep it open to let you know what all the influences were that informed this season. But I think what we should do is not hold back any longer and launch into the season and talk about each of the individual plays. And the first play that we're opening with is interesting, and it's the Penelopiad, which is Margaret Atwood's glorious retelling of Homer's epic, The Odyssey. And it might sound, what is the connection to Shakespeare with that one? But the Renaissance was so interesting, was a period that was so inspired by the tales of classical antiquity, the Greeks and the Romans. These stories are so, so important to the plays of Shakespeare and all the plays of of the Renaissance. And so it's really appropriate for me that we begin with a Canadian author, a contemporary author, retelling one of the greatest and oldest stories ever told.
Mm-hmm.